In order to understand the origins of the Nazi Party, it's important to understand the history of how World War One ended and what happened in Germany just after the end of the First World War. Now, the First World War basically came to an end when there was an abortive revolution in Germany. The German people were growing very tired, not only of the very difficult economic conditions, which were the result of the British blockade. The British Navy had very effectively blockaded Germany, and many key imports were not coming in, and this caused tremendous economic hardship in Germany. And on top of that, of course, the huge casualties being sustained by all of the nations, including the Germans during the First World War, made the population very restless. Basically, men were sick and tired of facing certain death in the trenches, and the very large, powerful Communist Party in Germany it should be said that a revolution sort of coalesced around the large communist organization in Germany. Basically, the German workers and German soldiers hoisted the red flag and formed workers and soldiers Soviets or councils, just like they did in the Soviet Union during the Bolshevik Revolution, basically, or rather during the Russian Revolution, I should say, and that eventually, of course, resulted in communism coming to Russia. The difference between the German Revolution, which, needless to say, this revolution sabotaged the German war effort. It brought it to an abrupt halt. The difference between the German Revolution and the revolution in the Soviet Union was, of course, the fact that the German Revolution was unsuccessful. Interpretations of as to just exactly why that happened vary. At any rate, it's important to understand that the army in Germany remained loyal to the vested interests, and they're the very large German middle class also looked askance at the revolution, so that basically it did not succeed. Now, we're going to touch back on some events during the course of this abortive German revolution in the next broadcast, perhaps the next two broadcasts. What I'd like to look at in this program here, and what we're going to be looking at, is the functioning of an organization called the FEHME, last name F-E-H-M-E. Now, the FEHME was an ancient organization which had been used by the German Junkers, the feudal landowning class, to basically stamp out any threat of peasant rebellion. Any peasants or anybody in that society who offered the possibility of mounting a significant challenge to the powers of the manorial lords was promptly executed. And the FEHME operated in secrecy. It operated at night. They killed in a ritualistic fashion, and it was in many ways very similar stylistically. Organizations are basically interchangeable and to a considerable extent synonymous. They were called the Free Corps, or the so-called Freikorps, spelled F-R-E-I-K-O-R-P-S, the German term for Free Corps. It's also known as the Black Reichswehr, and the Reichswehr being the German army, the Black Reichswehr being an underground component of that very same organization, okay? Now, both the Freikorps and Black Reichswehr units, which, remember, were underground military units operating in Germany after the end of World War One. Supposedly, the German army had been demobilized, but as I said, continued to operate in a clandestine, de facto fashion. The Freikorps and Black Reichswehr both, in essence, revived the FEHME, and the FEHME was reorganized in Germany and served to systematically assassinate not only all of the leaders of the German, the abortive German Revolution, but also to systematically wipe out all of the democratic political leadership in the Weimar Republic, and this paved the way for Nazism. And it's worth noting that virtually all of the key Nazis were key participants in the Freikorps and Black Reichswehr FEHME killings, okay? Now, perhaps the best account of the FEHME assassination program, which, again, eliminated not only the revolutionary leaders of Germany, but also all of the democratic leadership of Weimar Germany, and directly paved the way for Hitler's rise to power. The best account of this organization's functioning is in a book called The Plot Against the Peace. That was authored by Michael Sayers, S-A-Y-E-R-S, and Albert E. Kahn, K-A-H-N. And the book was published in hardcover in 1945 by the Dial Press. And in describing the operations of the FEMA and its origins, Sayers and Kahn write as follows in The Plot Against the Peace. After the last war, that being World War I, the dreaded FEMA was revived in Germany as the secret weapon of the underground officers' corps of the General Staff, financed by the Junkers and industrialists. When the FEMA returned to Germany following the 1918 armistice, writes the European journalist Paul Winkler in his book The Thousand-Year Conspiracy, its reappearance was due to the initiative of two groups of interests, the Junkers and the leaders of heavy industry in Westphalia. In any event, every clue to the crimes of the revived FEMA uncovered by German tribunals or contemporary newspapers in their exposures led directly either to the Junkers or to heavy industry. The principal aim was to execute, one by one, the leaders of the young German Republic. The FEMA directly paved the way for Nazism in Germany. Within 3 years after the signing of the peace, no less than 354 FEMIC assassinations were perpetuated in Germany against Germans interested in upholding German democracy and world peace. One by one, in the name of the vengeance of the FEMA, the best leaders of the German democracy were wiped out. The assassinations occurred with baffling regularity. In every case, as the various trials and investigations disclosed, the killers were German army officers, generally staff officers, and only rarely non-commissioned officers. All of these officers belonged to the underground military organizations of the General Staff, the so-called Freikorps and Black Reichswehr. Each Freikorps and Black Reichswehr unit had its own FEMA. By the law of the FEMA, the bloody task, unquote, the actual killing, was considered to be the privilege of the higher-ranking officers. Protected by the German General Staff, whose will they executed, the officer murderers of the FEMA acted with incredible boldness. They openly warned of their intention to kill and boasted of the killings. Almost without exception, the FEMA killers went unpunished. Usually, they simply vanished after the murder. When arrested and brought to trial before the German courts, they were acquitted or subjected to fines or ridiculously small prison terms, and then pardoned or permitted to escape. In the innumerable cases of minor political murders, where the victims of the FEMA were communists, Catholic, or Jews, no punishment at all was meted out by the German courts. A German murderer is not a murderer when the victim is a Jew, a Catholic, or a communist, unquote, indignantly reported E. A. Maurer in a dispatch to the Nation on March in a dispatch to the Nation on March 11th, 1925. Who decides? The courts. Maurer, by the way, is M O W R E R. That was written by an American correspondent in Germany 8 years before Hitler came to power. And next, Sayers and Kahn go into a description of the FEMA killings, and we're going to pick right up with this. Now, it's worth keeping in mind, as Sayers and Kahn mentioned in their passage, that the FEMA assassinations were directly responsible for Hitler's rise to power because they systematically eliminated not only the leaders of the abortive German Revolution, but all of the democratic leadership of the Weimar Republic. Keep that in mind as you listen to the description of the FEMA provided here by Sayers and Kahn. They begin by describing the murder, the FEMIC assassinations of the two main figures of the German Revolution, a woman named Rosa Luxemburg and a fellow by the name of Karl Liebknecht. Luxemburg, L-U-X-U-M-B-E-R-G. Karl Liebknecht, L-I-E-B-K-N-E-C-H-T. Okay, and they describe how those people were murdered and how Liebknecht and Rosenberg were murdered. And basically how Luxemburg, I should say, was murdered, and how their killers were acquitted, and how they went on to become leading officers in the SS. The two key figures there are a fellow by the name of Captain von Flughartung, P-F-L-U-G-K-H-A-R-T-U-N-G, and a Lieutenant Vogel, V-O-G-E-L. And the section of the FEMIC assassinations that we're going to pick up with here concerns the next victim of the FEMIC assassination units of the Freikorps and Black Reichswehr. That was a fellow by the name of Kurt Eisner, last name E-I-S-N-E-R. Sayers and Kahn write of Eisner's killing. The next FEMA victim was Kurt Eisner, prime minister of the short-lived revolutionary Bavarian Republic, which was ruthlessly suppressed by the officers' regiments of the general staff. On February 21st, 1919, Kurt Eisner was waylaid near his home and murdered by two shots in his head. The killer was the high-ranking army officer Count Arco Valley, last name Arco-Valley. Again, public clamor forced official action. Arco was arrested, tried, and found guilty and sentenced to death. Then the FEMA went into operation to protect. An ultimatum from Captain Dietl, D-I-E-T-L, of the Bavarian Reichswehr to the Bavarian government read, quote, "Either Arco will be pardoned, or you will all be hanged by tomorrow," unquote. Arco's sentence was promptly commuted to, quote, "confinement in a fortress," unquote. Later, Arco's sentence was suspended, and he was appointed by the German Social Democratic Republic as director of the Süddeutsche Lufthansa, a major state-controlled aviation concern. By 1929, Arco was a key liaison between the Nazi Party and German industry. When Hitler came to power, the assassin of Kurt Eisner became one of the heads of the Nazi commercial aviation, key instrument of German intrigue and espionage throughout the world. Arco's protector, Captain Dietl of the Bavarian Reichswehr, became the first open Nazi officer in the German army. In 1943, Hitler delivered a special funeral oration for Dietl, who, as commander of the Nazi Wehrmacht on the Murmansk front, had met with an unexpected death in Russia. In 1919, revolutionary Bavaria was a concentration point for FEMA operations. On the estates of Bavarian Junkers, the underground officers' corps maintained their secret arms caches and military training centers. By 1921, Adolf Hitler's Nazi Party had its headquarters in Munich, the capital of Bavaria. One by one, the leaders of the Bavarian Democratic Revolution were systematically eliminated by the FEMA. On May 2nd, 1919, Gustav Landauer, L-A-N-D-A-U-E-R, famous German Shakespearean authority and philologist, former minister of education in the Bavarian Republic, was kidnapped, beaten, and shot to death by a FEMA unit of German officers led by Baron von Gagen, last name G-A-G-E-N. Eyewitnesses to the crime testified that Baron von Gagen knocked Landauer down with a club, and he and other officers trampled on the elderly scholar and kicked him. Amid shouts and applause, non-commissioned officer Degele, last name D-I-G-E-L-E, yelled, "Won't the pig die at all? Wird denn das Schwein gar nicht sterben?" and fired a shot through Landauer's back, which killed him. At the trial, the court fined Baron von Gagen 300 marks. Non-commissioned officer Degele was accused of manslaughter, unquote, but acquitted on the grounds that, quote, "he could have been under the impression that he was acting under orders," unquote. Proceedings against all other officers involved were suspended. During a session of the Bavarian Landtag in the summer of 1921, Deputy Karl Gareis, last name G-A-R-E-I-S, exhibited a pile of documents and announced, quote, "I have here the evidence of a 1,000 years conspiracy, evidence which I shall present to you shortly," unquote. Gareis was understood to be referring to the operations of the FEMA and its notorious connection with the Junkers, but Gareis's evidence was never made public. A few days after his speech in the Landtag, Deputy Gareis was accosted by two men in the street and shot to death. The assassins escaped and were never apprehended. The Bavarian police did not even try to find them. The FEMA killings went on. After their successes in Bavaria, the killers became bolder. On August 26, 1921, FEMA killers of the Freikorps unit commanded by Baron Manfred von Killinger, last name K-I-L-L-I-N-G-E-R, assassinated Reich Secretary of the Treasury Matthias Erzberger, leader of the German Catholic Centrist Party, who had proposed a tax plan contrary to the wishes of the Junkers and industrialists. Erzberger's last name, by the way, is E-R-Z-B-E-R-G-E-R. Erzberger was waylaid while on vacation in the Black Forest by two armed officers, Lieutenants Heinrich Tillesen and Heinrich Schultz, and shot in the back. As Erzberger lay on the ground, Tillesen and Schultz fired 11 more shots into his body. A few days later, aided by German government officials, the assassins escaped into Hungary. Subsequently, Tillerson became a high-ranking Nazi and married the daughter of the pro-Nazi Hungarian Prime Minister, Gembes, last name G-O-E-M-B-O-E-S. I'm not sure on the pronunciation of that. His accomplice, Schultz, became a lieutenant of the SS. The Femme Terror reached a climax with the daylight assassination on a Berlin street of the German Foreign Minister, Walter Rathenau, R-A-T-H-E-N-A-U, who had dared to oppose the secret war plans of the General Staff and had outraged the Nazis by signing the Rapallo Treaty of Friendship with Soviet Russia. Rathenau was publicly marked for Femic execution. In beer halls throughout Germany, fanatical officers sang, "Not abden Walter Rathenau, der Gottverdammte Judensau." Crack down Walter Rathenau, the goddamn Jewish sow. On June 23, 1922, Rathenau was assassinated in his car at the corner of Wallot Street in Berlin. As Rathenau's automobile slowed down, a black sports car drew up alongside it. Two men stood up in the black car, and one of them fired several shots at Rathenau with a Tommy gun. The other man flung a hand grenade. Subsequent investigation established that the black car had been placed at the disposal of the assassins by Saxonian Nazi industrialists. By the Saxonian Nazi industrialists, the brothers Johann and Franz Kuchenmeister of Freiburg, last name K-U-E-C-H-E-N-M-E-I-S-T-E-R. The Femme leader and originator of the assassination plot was Lieutenant Willy Gunther, key agent of the General Staff and temporary private secretary to Ludendorff. Gunther is G-U-E-N-T-H-E-R. Many other high-ranking officers were directly implicated. The two killers, First Lieutenants Erwin Kern and Hermann Fischer, were chased by police who trailed them to the Salak Castle near Kesel, where they had their hideout. The police opened fire and Kern was killed. Fischer committed suicide. The driver of the murder car, Ernst Werner Tachau, was arrested and sentenced to a term of imprisonment, but was later pardoned and joined the Nazi Party. Another accomplice in the crime, Ernst von Salomon, S-A-L-O-M-O-N, became one of the most famous Nazi propagandists, writing regularly in Goebbels' weekly newspaper, Das Reich. After Hitler came to power, the bodies of the two killers who died at Salak Castle were exhumed and reburied with great ceremony, and at Hitler's order, a monument was erected to their memory as, quote, Germany's national heroes, unquote. The murder of Rathenau eliminated the last prominent personality in Germany capable of obstructing the plans of the General Staff. The public Femic assassinations were halted. German newspapers reported that the Femme had been disbanded. But the Femme terror throughout Germany had not stopped. It operated continuously against the German populace. Week after week, the German local newspapers reported cases of bodies found in ditches, workers beaten to death, farmers hanged, merchants and intellectuals tortured and shot. Throughout the 1920s, the Femme was used to silence German citizens who happened to stumble on evidence of the secret war preparations of the General Staff, and against members of the Black Reichswehr itself who had incurred the wrath of the Underground Officers Corps. In later years, with the rise of organized Nazi murder gangs, the officer's Femme temporarily vanished from the German scene. The work of the Femme was carried on by the Gestapo and the SS, most of whose leaders had originally been leaders of the Femme. And that basically concludes the story of the Femme. Now, we're going to be coming back to the origins of German Nazism in the next broadcast, and in particular, we're going to take a look at how the personnel involved with the Femme, the Freikorps, and the Black Reichswehr were also directly involved with the actual formation of the German National Socialist Workers Party, the Nazi Party. And we're going to look at that relationship at length and in detail in the next broadcast, perhaps two broadcasts. Before concluding, let me sum up what we've looked at. We began by taking a look at basically summing up the history of the end of the First World War, namely the abortive revolution which took place in Germany, and that brought Germany to defeat in World War One. We then took a look at how the revolution was put down, and that this revolution resulted in the formation of underground German army units called the Black Reichswehr and Freikorps, and they in turn revived an ancient manorial terrorist organization in Germany called the FEMA. And the Freikorps and Black Reichswehr FEMA units systematically eliminated the leaders of the abortive revolution and also all of the democratic leadership in Germany. And we took a lengthy description, took a look at a lengthy description of the FEMIC assassinations provided very, very eloquently in The Plot Against the Peace by Michael Sayers and Albert E. Kahn. And keep in mind, as I said, that the FEMIC assassinations paved the way for Hitler's rise to power, and that many of the key figures in the Freikorps and Black Reichswehr FEMIC assassination program are going to crop up prominently in our examination of the formation of the German Nazi Party. And that will be compared with the with elements of the present-day Ku Klux Klan. That concludes this broadcast. My name is Dave Emery. Thanks for listening. Now, during this half hour, we're going to be continuing with our discussion of the origins of the Nazi Party in Germany, and by way of comparing this with certain elements of the contemporary Ku Klux Klan. Now, you recall that in the last broadcast, we covered the operations of the FEMA. That was a secret underground murder organization formed by the German General Staff, the Reichswehr, the German Army, between the two world wars. And what that organization did was to systematically exterminate the revolutionary and the democratic political leadership of Weimar Germany. Recall that, as we saw last week, World War I ended when there was an unsuccessful revolution in Germany. Basically, workers and soldiers sick of not only of the certainty of death in the trenches in World War I, but also of the severe economic conditions in Germany brought on by the successful British blockade of that country, which prevented imports from coming in and created, as I said, very harsh economic conditions. Well, they staged a revolution which, unlike the revolution in Russia, was unsuccessful and was put down by the army. Now, after this revolution, the leaders of that revolution, as well as all of the democratic political leaders in Weimar Germany, were systematically murdered by the FEMA, this secret underground organization set up by the German army. Now, in this broadcast, we're going to be continuing right where we left off last time with our discussion of these murder groups, and specifically, we're going to look at the connections between these groups and the fledgling Nazi Party. Now, the key name to remember with regard to not only the operations of the FEMA, this underground murder organization of the Reichswehr, but also with regard to the origins of the German Nazi Party, is a fellow named Ernst Röhm, last name R-O-H-M. And the book we're going to begin with, and in fact that's going to occupy our attention throughout most of the broadcast, is a book called Der Führer. Der Führer was published by a German author named Konrad Heiden, last name H-E-I-D-E-N. And the English language edition was published in 1944 by Houghton Mifflin and Company. Okay? Der Führer, Conrad Heiden, Houghton Mifflin, hardcover edition, 1944. And in Der Führer, Conrad Heiden identifies Ernst Röhm as the key figure in directing the underground murder organizations of the FEMA. And recall, those the FEMIC killing groups were formed out of the so-called Black Reichswehr, or Freikorps, or Freikorps, as it would be said in English. Now, these were the underground extensions of the German army. And Conrad Heiden in Der Führer identifies Ernst Röhm as the key figure in the formation of the Reichswehr and the Black Reichswehr and the Freikorps, both of those contributing to the FEMIC murder organizations. Now, in addition to Röhm, a key name to remember in the passage I'm about to read you is Colonel von Epp, V-O-N-E-P-P. He was the German General Staff Officer who was technically speaking over Ernst Röhm and appears to have been his contact with the German General Staff. We're going to run up against von Epp here again in a second. Of Rome's pivotal role in forming the FEMIC organizations of the Black Reichswehr and the Freikorps, Conrad Heiden writes as follows in Der Führer. This Röhm, more than any other in his circle, is the key figure we were seeking when we asked, who sent out the murderers? Who gave the judges their orders? A young officer in his mid-30s, a captain like a thousand others, the kind who might gladly and easily disappear in the mass, he stood modestly aside in the dazzling parades where generals and marshals, personally responsible, perhaps, for the loss of the war, were applauded by a misguided patriotic youth. Röhm was only an adjutant to the chief of the infantry troop stationed in Bavaria, a certain Colonel von Epp. But from this modest post,
He established, in defiance of the law and against the will of every minister in Berlin and Munich, a volunteer army of 100,000 men, calling themselves modestly the Arnewohnerwehr, the citizens' defense. When this armed mass was finally disbanded by orders from above, he formed new nuclei. New organizations kept springing up with all sorts of names under constantly changing official leaders, all having ostensibly nothing to do with the Reichswehr. Actually, all were an extension of the Reichswehr under the command of Rome. Very important to remember, as we saw last time, that the Freikorps, the Black Reichswehr, the FEMA, were extensions of the German army operating in defiance of the civilian authority in Weimar Germany. The next point that Conrad Haydn goes on to make here that we're going to cover concerns the cooperation of certain elements of the Allied occupation force in Germany. Many of these so-called control commissions were sympathetic to the positions of the Freikorps and Black Reichswehr because they feared the possibility of revolution in Germany, and so they actively took part in seeing to it that these underground German army organizations got the armaments that were left over from World War I. Haydn describes this as follows. A gigantic arsenal had been left behind by the fallen German army. In the peace treaty, Germany had promised to destroy it. The Allies supervised the process by control commissions, sitting in the large cities of Germany and traveling throughout the country. These arms had to be saved. In Bavaria, Rome undertook this task. He was able to persuade a few of the Allied officers that these old armored cars and rusty machine guns could be of no use in serious warfare, but would come in handy for combating the world revolution which was moving through Germany toward the Rhine. This strange collaboration with the Allied organs must have been very close. In his memoirs, Rome indicates as much in passing, praising certain British officers and mentioning an Italian, Major Gramaccini, last name G-R-A-M-M-A-C-I-N-I. Now, the next thing that Haydn goes on to describe here is the fact that Ernst Röhm basically was the key man who formed the German Nazi Party. Now, this was the German Nazi Party, that is, the German National Socialist Workers' Party, basically grew out of a defunct political party. Now, the key figure, again, with the formation of the German Nazi Party was Ernst Röhm. And it's important to note a couple of things here. First of all, that in its inception, the German Nazi Party was nothing more than a front for German military intelligence. The German Nazi Party was basically a vehicle for introducing the German army into civilian life for the purposes of fomenting political reaction and eventually promoting a political situation in Germany favorable to the realization of the long-standing dream of German generals and industrialists of world conquest, okay? But remember, in its inception, the German Nazi Party was nothing more than a front for German military intelligence. And it's worth noting that the same person who, according to Haydn, was the key figure with regard to the formation of the Freikorps and the Black Reichswehr, and to all appearances the liaison officer between the regular German general staff and these so-called Freikorps, these so-called underground organizations, again, actually an extension of the German army, was Ernst Röhm. He then becomes the founder of the German Nazi Party, and after the Nazi Party was founded, Ernst Röhm became the head of the SA, the Sturmabteilung, who were the brown shirts. These were the fellows who actually went out into the streets of Weimar Germany and, through force of arms, basically conquered all of their opponents by either driving them underground or killing them outright, okay? And as Haydn points out in the passage I'm about to read, entire companies of the supposedly demobilized German army were turned out in the ranks of the Sturmabteilung, the brown shirts, up to company strength, okay? Haydn writes as follows, in der Führer of the founding of the Nazi Party. Röhm founded the National Socialist German Workers' Party. It might be said to have existed before him under the simpler name of the German Workers' Party. But that was a club, sitting in the back rooms of little restaurants, talking. At all events, a mere idea. And an idea it remained until the club, seeking to win over the German workers, became the party of soldiers. This was Rome's work. He discovered the club, joined it, an officer among workers, and not he alone. With commands, he forced his soldiers. With pleas, he drove his comrades into it. Thus, the party became a political troop. Whole Reichswehr companies marched through the streets in civilian clothes as National Socialists. Thus arose the formation which later, as the SA, became the basic party formation. So again, not to belabor the point, the German Nazi Party in its inception, a front for German military intelligence, the supposedly demobilized German army simply being turned out in the ranks of the stormtroopers, the brown shirts. Now, where does Adolf Hitler fit into this whole business? Basically, Adolf Hitler, just like Ernst Röhm, was an underground, undercover, really, intelligence agent for the German army during this revolutionary period. Now, jumping back in time just a little bit, Hitler's first assignment as an undercover German army intelligence agent was to infiltrate the unsuccessful German revolution in the Munich area and betray it. And this he did quite effectively. Basically, he was a stool pigeon. Haydn writes about this in Der Führer as follows. When the white troops, that's the reactionary troops, when the white troops entered Munich, they went to the 19th Infantry Barracks and found a body of soldiers which an eyewitness later called a wild red rabble, unquote. Every 10th man chosen at random was stood up against the wall and shot. Only one was set aside from the very first to be spared. His position was only too clear. When the high officers of the Munich Reichswehr fled before the radical uprising, they had left this man behind to observe and report. A dangerous commission requiring courage, but ugly. A few months previous, this man had attracted the attention of his officers in a strange way. They all noticed him, one of them later recollected, because his salutes were so punctilious as to be provocative in those revolutionary months when most of the soldiers defiantly refrained from saluting at all. When the government troops stormed Munich, his comrades wanted to help defend the city. He made a speech dissuading them. His comrades had suspected him of being a spy, and during the Soviet regime he barely escaped arrest. Now he became the executioner. After May 2nd, an examining commission sent hundreds of men to the slaughterhouse wall. This man soon came to the attention of the commission, which used him as an informer. He delivered his reports in writing and later boasted of them. When he was ordered before the examining commission, wrote one of his friends, his indictments cast a merciless clarity upon the unspeakable disgrace of the military treason practiced by the Jewish dictatorship of Munich's Soviet period, unquote. By rank, this stool pigeon was a corporal. By nationality, strange to say, an Austrian. His stated profession was painter and architect. His name was Adolf Hitler. Well, that passage is essentially accurate in all but one small respect. His real name, that is to say, Hitler's real name, was not Adolf Hitler at all. That was an intelligence alias. His real name was Adolf Schickelgruber. Now, following his role infiltrating the German Revolution in the Munich area, his next assignment, basically Hitler's next assignment, was to join the fledgling Nazi Party. Remember, this was essentially at this stage an intelligence front under the direction of Ernst Röhm. A good account of this is provided in a book we've covered before. The book is called The Plot Against the Peace, authored by Michael Sayers and Albert E. Kahn, published in March of 1945 by the Dial Press, hardcover edition. This, of course, was the book that we used in the last broadcast for our description of the FEMA. And of Adolf Hitler's infiltration, or of Adolf Hitler's next assignment following the infiltration of the German Revolution, Sayers and Kahn write as follows. In the spring of 1919, a so-called Reichswehr instructor, unquote, or spy, stationed as a corporal at the depot of the 16th Regiment in Munich, received orders from his superiors to go into an organization called the German Workers' Party and to help other Reichswehr agents reorganize it as an instrument of general staff propaganda for the post-war period. The officer who gave these orders was Captain Ernst Röhm, founder of the Freikorps Reichsflagge and in charge of Reichswehr political intrigue in the Munich area. The name of the spy who received these orders was Adolf Schickelgruber, a former pan-German propagandist from Vienna who had adopted the alias of Adolf Hitler and was currently being trained as a mass agitator by the political department of the District Army Command under General von Lossow, L-O-S-S-O-W. The German Workers' Party had originally been set up by the Pan-German League in collaboration with the Kaiser's Socialists, unquote, the social democratic ministers in the German cabinet, to win popular support for the Kaiser's war aims. After the armistice, the organization had collapsed. On instructions from the Reichswehr political department, the pan-German agent Gottfried Feder was trying to revive the German Workers' Party as an anti-Semitic and anti-communist mass propaganda organization. Hitler was one of several pan-German propagandists, spies, and agents sent by the Reichswehr political department to assist Feder in this work. In the first pages of Mein Kampf, Hitler writes, "I joined a regiment then in garrison at Munich as instructing officer. One day I was ordered by my superiors to look into an apparently political organization that, under the name of the German Workers' Party, was soon to hold a meeting at which Gottfried Feder was to speak. Hitler joined the German Workers' Party as member number 7. Other members included Captain Ernst Röhm, the Reichswehr agents and pan-German propagandists Gottfried Feder, Anton Drexler, and Dietrich Eckert, and the Freikorps leader General von Epp. These men reorganized the party and renamed it the German Workers' National Socialist Party. Among the first recruits were the Egyptian-born international adventurer and ex-officer Rudolf Hess, and the Baltic White Guard and anti-Semitic propagandist from Tsarist Russia, Alfred Rosenberg. Out of this underworld political alliance of pan-German propagandists, Reichswehr spies, Freikorps leaders, and international adventurers, the Nazi Party was born." A couple of points to make there. First of all, recall that General von Epp was Rome's superior. Rome was his adjutant in the Munich area. And we're going to talk about General von Epp here again in a second. Note also that these people, Dietrich Eckert, Rudolf Hess, and Alfred Rosenberg, went on to become key members of the German Nazi Party, and that they were all there at the inception of this organization, acting in the capacity of German army intelligence agents. Okay, again, the Nazi Party in its inception was nothing more than an intelligence front for German military intelligence. Okay, now keep that in mind, and we're going to go back to Der Führer by Konrad Haydn and take a look at a couple of other interesting chapters, I guess you could say, in the formation of this intelligence front. Now, keep in mind, as you listen to all of this, the information that we covered concerning the Ku Klux Klan, where agents like Roy, where people like Roy Frankhauser, David Duke, Bill Wilkinson, and others, although Klan leaders, turned out to be government agents and informers. We can't draw any definite conclusions from this, but the unnerving similarity between the contemporary Ku Klux Klan and the initial stages of the German Nazi Party, where an ostensibly political organization was really just an intelligence front, and where all of its key leaders were actually informers or agents of the German army, is unnerving. Keep in mind also that in its initial stages, the Nazi Party was denigrated by much the same kind of talk that one hears about the Klan. Basically, it was just a bunch of street rabble, didn't represent any kind of serious threat. And while I'm not implying that the Klan in and of itself could become a serious political force in American society, organizations like this, particularly if the economy should collapse, as some are saying it might, could become a very, very, very strong force in American society in light of the social dislocation that a serious depression could cause. The depression and the desperation it engendered, the Great Depression, that is, and the desperation it engendered, was one of the major forces in bringing the Nazis to power. And keep in mind, the role of these undercover agents and the unnerving similarity with certain with large elements of Klan leadership today. Again, discussing Adolf Hitler and the inception of the Nazi Party here. Going back to Der Führer by Konrad Haydn. The party did not yet bear the name National Socialist. The term was still unknown. But the most revealing item in Hitler's report about the first meeting of this party is that he was surrounded by a body of personal supporters, that these supporters intervened, unquote, against interrupters, and that they had sidearms. In other words, a troop of armed soldiers founded the National Socialist Party. The employee of the Political Bureau of the Munich District Army Command had come with a squad of Reichswehr soldiers. According to reports from a hostile source, they belonged to a company of mine throwers. First, he had his political opponents driven out with cold steel. This is the meaning of intervention, unquote, as everyone knows who ever attended a National Socialist meeting in those years. Then he shouted at the terrorized crowd, "If anyone else dares, let him speak up against the program." Before the meeting, he was not sure whether he was an orator or not, but he did feel sure of his sidearms. So, again, in its inception, the German army was the main force with the Nazi party, and anybody who would disagree with the position of that party found themselves confronted by armed force in the form of the brown shirts, again, the supposedly demobilized German army. The last aspect in the infancy of the German Nazi Party we're going to look at concerns the acquisition of a newspaper called the Munich Observer, which was then it had its name changed to the Racial Observer, or Völkischer Beobachter, as it would be in German. The acquisition of this paper by the fellow named von Epp, and initially a colonel when we first looked at him as Ernst Röhm's superior in the Munich area. He, by the time of the purchase of the Munich Observer, was a major general. And recall that Mr. von Epp, or Herr von Epp, was one of the charter members of the Nazi Party. And keep in mind, when Röhm was running the supposedly underground, well, actually the underground murder organizations of the German army, his contact with the general staff was General von Epp. And General von Epp purchased the newspaper Munich Observer for the Nazi Party, which then became its official newspaper after a change of name. General von Epp's role in the purchase of the Nazi Party paper was described by Conrad Haydn as follows. The Reichswehr went on supporting its child and, if possible, guiding its steps. There was a little weekly in Munich, originally nothing but a rather suspect, scandal-mongering enterprise called the Munich Observer, a gossip sheet, not more. After the war, it slowly turned anti-Semitic, changed its name into Racial Observer, Völkischer Beobachter. On account of internal and personal quarrels, the paper was rather cool toward Hitler and his friends. Now, Major General Franz von Epp, commander of the Bavarian infantry troops and the body to which Röhm was the right hand, bought the Völkischer Beobachter for the National Socialists. Rather, he raised a fund among wealthy persons and gave it to Dietrich Eckert to buy a paper. To be sure, the rich men were little inclined to support a party calling itself socialist, but Hitler publicly set them straight. For National Socialists, it goes without saying that industrial capital, since it creates values, will remain untouched. We combat only Jewish international loan capital, unquote. So again, General von Epp, Röhm's superior, Röhm being commander of the Freikorps and Black Reichswehr, founder of the Nazi Party and head of the Sturmabteilung, the SA, his superior officer buys the Munich Observer to become the Nazi Party paper. That pretty much winds things up for the broadcast. Summing up, we began by taking a look at the pivotal role that Ernst Röhm played in the Reichswehr, the Black Reichswehr, the Freikorps, the FEMA, the underground murder organizations of the German army. Following that, we took a look at the collaboration of certain elements of the Allied occupation force in Germany with the underground murder organizations of the German army. They basically, that is to say, the Allied control commissions, feared the possibility of revolution in Germany and saw to it that the Black Reichswehr was well armed. Following that, we took a look at Ernst Röhm's pivotal role in founding the Nazi Party, initially a front for German military intelligence, and we took a look at Röhm's role with the stormtroopers as well. Again, the Nazi Party is simply a vehicle for introducing the German army into civilian society. Following that, we took a look at Adolf Hitler's role in infiltrating the German Revolution in the Munich area and his betrayal of that revolution. And we also took a look at his assignment by Ernst Röhm to infiltrate the fledgling German National Socialist Workers' Party, the Nazi Party that Röhm had founded. And we took a look also at the role of the stormtroopers, the supposedly demobilized German army, in quelling quelling opposition to this fledgling German party. And last but not least, we took a look at the role of General von Epp, Rome's commanding officer, in purchasing the newspaper which was to become the Völkischer Beobachter, the official Nazi Party paper. Keep in mind, again, the comparison between the contemporary Ku Klux Klan with the leaders of the Ku Klux Klan today, most of them appearing to be government agents, and the leaders of the fledgling German Nazi Party, agents of German military intelligence. That concludes this broadcast. My name is Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.
Well, we're going to wrap it up at this point, as it's just about 11 o'clock straight up, and we are going to be rocketing on out of here. And thanks for listening to Radio Free America. Stay tuned to KFJC. Anton is coming up next. He's going to be playing music forever. I mean, until everybody dies. So there'll be plenty of music for everybody. Don't go away. It's going to be lots of fun. I've seen the stuff he's picking out. And if you don't like it, well, you're just not a fun person. So once again, Nip Tuck, Radio Free America, Dave Emery, you got it all. We'll see you later. Thanks again. Bye-bye.